have the ability to walk in and pay whatever's required to see whoever they need to see. There are those of us that can't do that. And we deserve a chance to live a healthy life too. We made bad decisions. Some of us have, some of us are mentally ill. And decisions were made for us. But we would like a fair shake. We would like a chance to have affordable, good health coverage, and give us a chance to show that we're people, we're human, and we deserve the same rights as everybody else.
That's Skid Row resident Kevin McWhorter. Coming up, how Obamacare transformed healthcare for the homeless residents of downtown LA. But first, for over 15 years, immigrant detention facilities had to follow a list of requirements. Jailers had to inform detainees about access to medical care, and they had to keep track of time spent in solitary confinement. All of this could change under President Trump. With the crackdown on illegal immigration moving quickly, jail space is harder to come by. And loosening these requirements can encourage more sheriff and local officials to make their jails available. Caitlin Dickerson covers immigration policy for the New York Times, and it is good of you to join us.
Thanks for having me.
So first, clarify for us, what kinds of facilities are we talking about here? Local jails, private prisons, ICE detention centers, what?
So we're actually talking about a mix. These new rules are going to apply to facilities. They're known as non-dedicated facilities. So those are really, it's any kind of facility that holds a mix of immigrants and criminals together. So that can happen in a privately run facility. It can happen in a county jail, which is quite common. And it's about 40% right now of immigrants are held in these types of facilities.
Okay. And when we talk about immigrant detainees, what does that mean? Are they people in and on their way out or of the country, or undocumented immigrants who've committed crimes?
Sure. So we're talking about people who are being held in custody for violating immigration law. And this includes some people who've committed crimes, but those people would have already paid their time, spent time in criminal custody, and then been transferred into ICE custody. And then even more common would be people who don't have a criminal record, but who are just here illegally and being held for that administrative purpose. So it's hard for people to parse the difference sometimes in their minds, because you think if somebody's confined, they're confined. But it's actually very different. It's an administrative hold versus a criminal hold.
And they could be awaiting hearings as well.
They're all awaiting hearings, and they're all facing potential deportation. So they're essentially waiting to fight their case to be able to stay.
Okay, now let's talk about these requirements for the jails that have been in place already for over a decade. What rules do guards have to follow as things stand now?
So right now, the rules are really expansive. They cover literally dozens of facets. The set of rules is over 400 pages long, which is common when you think about a correctional facility and all that goes into keeping human beings alive and healthy. But these rules are specifically tailored to address the unique circumstances of immigrants. So, for example, immigrants facing deportation don't have the right to a lawyer. So these rules address that specifically and require that the immigrants are given free phone calls to the U.S. government and to their national consulates, that they have access to a law library so that they can try to defend themselves. And then there are rules that limit the use of things like solitary confinement. This is, as we know, the harshest form of punishment in confinement in the United States, and using it for somebody who's on an administrative hold as opposed to a criminal hold has been really limited thus far. Because, again, the federal government sort of looks at these detainees differently.
And I imagine translation services are also an important part of this.
Yes. Thanks for pointing that out. That's a big piece, and it's sort of sprinkled throughout the rules because it applies to, you know, making sure that people know in their own language how to access medical care. But also, if they face a disciplinary hearing, making sure that they can have an English-speaking representative to speak on their behalf. So translation is a big part.
Okay, but now there are new contracts with these detention centers and jails that are in the works that would change these rules. First, why is the administration rewriting the contracts?
Well, the administration is preparing to ramp up both enforcement, so that means arrests, and also detention really dramatically in the coming months. And they're basically trying to come up with ways to make that process go quicker. And these extra rules are something that sheriffs who run jails in particular have bristled at somewhat over the years, because they've got to make additional accommodations for their immigrant detainees. And they say, hey, look, I already have a set of rules for the criminal criminals are people who are charged with crimes who I'm holding, you know, those rules should really be enough. So in order to really quickly ramp up deportation, this is one thing that the administration has come up with that might be able to help with that effort.
And how are the rules changing then? And you spoke to two Homeland Security officials who declined to be named, and they told you that these new jail contracts have fewer details in the regulations.
Yeah, it's fewer details is sort of an understatement. So the current set of rules are 455 pages long. And as I say, they go into specific detail about what's required, and they give specific examples of what's required. What the administration is turning to instead now is an 18-page document. So whereas things like solitary confinement make up entire categories, you know, over a dozen pages in the current set of rules, solitary confinement is limited to just one sentence in this new set of policies. So it's very, very bare bones, and it really leaves up to interpretation what is sufficient and what isn't, because it isn't specific. And that's really the central issue that immigrant advocates are raising and that the DHS officials I interviewed raised.
Well, I'm thinking there in the past, there have been cases of detainee mistreatment, and this is goes back before the election. We should remember that Obama deported 2.5 million undocumented people before Trump was elected. Just remind us how easily things can go wrong with the rules as they stand now, with detainees' health and welfare, and particularly with non-English speaking people.
That's an important point. I mean, look, it's hard to keep people sort of healthy and to care for them in a way that's sort of above and beyond the traditional penal model when at the end of the day, they're being held in jails and they do have these special circumstances, not just translation, but officials pointed me to the fact that people who are recent entrants often who've just got to the U.S., often they're dealing with particular health issues because they've just gone through this journey and sort of been traveling without food and water for days or weeks or months.
And maybe so, confiscated medicine.
And may have their medicine confiscated. Right. I think you're referring to an example that I wrote about. So there are countless examples and really countless reports, both NGO reports and also U.S. government reports that point to really specific examples where things have gone wrong. So Irene Bamenga, I wrote about, she was a French immigrant who was detained for overstaying her visa and had heart failure. Her medication was confiscated and kept from her, even though she requested multiple times medical help, even wrote a written request for medical help, never got her medication, and she died in detention.
Well, given this and how serious, well, the question is, how serious are the implications then of these rule changes, given the conditions already?
Sure. It's really hard to tell, and we certainly don't want to suggest that deaths are going to dramatically increase. We don't know that. We know that an NIH study, National Institute of Health study, pointed to these detention standards as something that has helped to lower the rate of deaths in detention. But this plan is certainly still moving. It's something that's been approved by ICE, but that hasn't been put into effect, mostly because ICE doesn't yet have the money to sign new contracts yet. When it gets that money from Congress, the final decisions will be made, and then we'll really be able to tell how big effect this will have.
So this is all in flux. Caitlin Dickerson, a national immigration correspondent for the New York Times, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, last year, Alaska's health insurance marketplaces were near collapse. And then the state came up with an ingenious fix, how Alaska cured Obamacare. That's next here on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. President Trump has talked much about Obamacare exploding. That's when only the sickest people buy coverage, insurers drop out of the marketplace, and prices go up dramatically. But Alaska was able to keep premiums from spiking this year. The bump in cost was just 7% instead of the expected 42%. And that's because the state subsidized Obamacare and saved it. Dylan Scott is a policy reporter for Vox.com, where he covers healthcare, and he's here to explain what went on in Alaska. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, first, tell us about last year. How close was Alaska's system to imploding? The president says exploding, but imploding, and why?
Sure. So Alaska, historically, as some background, Alaska always has very high medical costs because it's such a rural state, a big rural state that just naturally drives costs up. And so in the Obamacare markets that have been in place since 2014, the state had dwindled down to having only one health insurer offering a plan in 2016, and they were looking at huge premium increases, 42% last year, as you pointed out. And so what the state decided to do was they instituted what's known as a reinsurance program. And what that sounds wonky, but what it means is the state decided it would pay money to the health insurer in its state that was offering Obamacare coverage for the most expensive patients, the sickest people who had high medical costs. And because the plan had to pay those costs, that was part of what was driving premiums up. So the state said, all right, we're going to pay some money to the health insurer in order to offset some of those high costs for those most expensive patients. And that will allow them to keep their premiums lower, because without this extra money coming from the state, the only way for the health plan to make up the difference is to raise everybody's premium. And so it seems to be working pretty well. As you pointed out, in 2017, the state, the one health plan offering offering insurance in Alaska increased its premium by only 7%, which compared to the national average was much lower than expected.
Right. And Alaska poured some $55 million of revenue from taxes into this program in order to
right.
do this. And so Alaska saved customers money. Alaska spent some of their money, but they also saved the federal government money. How so?
Yeah, so that's the other wrinkle in this. So the federal government under Obamacare pays subsidies to people who qualify for them to help to offset the cost of their premiums. And so the more the premiums increase, the more the federal government has to pay to health insurance plans to help people afford those premiums. And so under this health reinsurance program, because Alaska was able to significantly lower the rate of premium increases, that meant the federal government didn't have to spend X extra amount of dollars to keep up with the increasing premiums. And so it ends up being a good deal for both the state and the federal government. And kind of the next step in this will be Alaska has asked the federal government to help pay for this reinsurance program. They've told the federal government, hey, we're paying this money to these health insurers to keep premiums from increasing, which saves you, the federal government, money. So why don't you kick some money back to us so we're not funding this program all on our own and just saving you the money?
And looking forward to 2018, what does healthcare in Alaska look like under the marketplace? Are there lower premiums, more people buying Obamacare? Where is it headed?
So right now, obviously, we're still kind of in the decision-making phase. But right now, it looks like there will still only be one plan in Alaska. But it looks like it's at least possible that premiums in Alaska will actually go down next year, which is really historically unheard of and would be a real exception to what we've seen in Obamacare markets elsewhere. So for people who want to see these markets stabilized and see them work, this is a really encouraging sign that this kind of program that helps insurers avoid these big premium increases really could work.
Are other states trying out Alaska's plan?
So this is... It's definitely caught other states' eyes. Minnesota is in the process of kind of actively planning a reinsurance program that looks a lot like Alaska's for all of the same reasons. And my colleague, Sarah Cliff, was at a big insurance conference over the weekend, and she said that she took note of the New York public officials who were in town for the conference were asking a lot of questions about what Alaska was doing. And so we can't say for sure at this point, but it wouldn't surprise me at all to start seeing more. We're already seeing a couple states look at this, and it wouldn't surprise me at all to see more and more turning to this kind of model to keep their premium increases in check.
Now, you might not be able to answer this, but how is the Trump administration viewing what Alaska is doing, and how is it playing in Washington?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, obviously, there's a lot of rhetoric about, as you pointed out at the top, about Obamacare imploding. But Tom Price, who is President Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary, has actually signaled to states that if they were interested in doing something like this, the federal government might be open to it. You know, I think in the end, people know that, you know, these marketplaces are where people are buying their insurance and coverage that's important to them, and so making them function is important. And so if you set the rhetoric aside for a minute and just look at what the Trump administration has said it's actually open to, you know, I think they would welcome the kind of things that Alaska are doing because it helps stabilize the market and make insurance affordable.
And just while we have you here in the last minute, moving away from Alaska and looking at this big picture, what are the politics of letting Obamacare die at this point?
That's a great question. Some people might have seen President Trump actually said yesterday that, you know, he still thinks the law is going to implode and Democrats should be scrambling to get him on the phone to figure out how to save it. But there's actually been some very interesting polling that suggests, you know, the American people look at it this way. Republicans are in charge of the federal government right now, and the majority of Americans think that they should do what they can to make Obamacare work. And if it doesn't, then they're going to put the responsibility on the people who are in charge right now, which is President Trump and the congressional Republicans.
Where does that leave the repeal and replace chorus, though?
Well, at the moment, that the repeal and replace plan that fizzled out at the end of the last month still seems dead. We're going to, I imagine, for the foreseeable future, see reports about new talks and backroom discussions and that sort of thing. But the bill died for a reason, because Republicans weren't able to agree on what should be in it. And there hasn't really been any indication yet that they've resolved those questions that stopped the bill in the first place.
Dylan Scott, he's a policy reporter for Vox.com. Dylan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, even though Congress is in recess right now, Republican lawmakers insist that they're still hard at work on a replacement plan for Obamacare. President Trump also said this week he could force Democrats to negotiate the law by scrapping federal funds that help low-income people pay for their health plans. With the prospect of repeal ever present, some clinics, especially those that serve L.A.'s homeless, are bracing for major changes to the law. On L.A.'s Skid Row, for instance, clinics have spent the last 3 years getting thousands of people living on the streets and in shelters enrolled in Medi-Cal, the state's version of Medicaid. We sent our producer, Michelle Alloy, down to Skid Row to see how Obamacare changed health care there as Republicans restart conversations about repealing it.
Kevin McWhorter sits down on an exam room table and begins untying his shoes.
And go ahead and take your socks off for me.
McWhorter is getting a foot exam from Dr. Lisa Adishu, who runs the Los Angeles Christian Health Center's clinic on Skid Row.
I want you to close your eyes and just tell me if I'm moving your toe up or down.
Adishu gently wiggles McWhorter's toes, checking for signs of nerve damage.
Down.
McWhorter has type 2 diabetes. He's also homeless. While diabetes is a manageable disease, if left untreated, cuts and scrapes can go unnoticed, leading to infections and, in severe cases, amputations.
There's so many people out here with amputated limbs because they didn't get the proper care. I want to keep mine.
Getting the proper care is easier for McWhorter since enrolling in Medi-Cal in 2014. He's one of the 3.5 million Californians and thousands of homeless individuals who benefited when the state expanded Medi-Cal to everyone living near or below poverty.
And when I received the card and it was like, bam, I can go to the doctor. I can go to, you know, and it really feels good to know that if there's something wrong, I can go get it taken care of.
Before Obamacare, someone like McWhorter would have struggled to qualify for Medi-Cal. Being poor wasn't enough. A person needed to have either young children or a disability. The latter category might have covered McWhorter, but he would have needed to prove not just his diagnosis, but also a progression of the disease, likely with detailed medical records. That's a big ask for someone who's homeless. Now, with those barriers removed, McWhorter is able to keep his insulin prescriptions filled, see specialists as needed, and keep his diabetes under control.
Diabetes is rocking. My blood pressure is like 127 over 63. I'm just fat. But I'm eating differently. They gave me a whole booklet on eating rabbit food. But, you know, it's healthy, and I want to live today.
As Obamacare rolled out in 2014, about a half dozen free clinics around Skid Row joined forces to enroll L.A.'s homeless in Medi-Cal. 3 years later, clinic staff say the outreach has reshaped how healthcare works for those living on Skid Row. At L.A. Christian Health Centers alone, the clinic signed up nearly 2,500 people for Medi-Cal. The clinic's insured rate, which previously hovered around a dismal 28%, jumped to nearly 70%. Newly covered services like optometry increased tenfold. Dental and mental health care visits both doubled. About a block away from L.A. Christian Health Centers and another Skid Row clinic, dental hygienists crouch over their patients' faces with drills and picks, leaving only their feet visible. John Wesley Health Centers is the largest provider of homeless health care services in Los Angeles, serving more than 8,000 homeless people last year. Between 2013 and 2014, the clinic helped enroll another nearly 4,400 people in Medi-Cal. With the expansion of coverage came the expansion of services.
This was only open one day a week because there was nothing to cover it. There was no insurance. Medicaid didn't cover dental care. People didn't have Medicaid. So we had these beautiful seven chairs, but we were only able to operate them one day a week.
Al Ballesteros is the chief executive officer of the John Wesley Clinic. He says it also saw a big uptick in its insured rate, from 17% to about 60%. Ballesteros says without Obamacare, many of the clinic's patients would go back to not having their health care, their dental care, their eye care, their mental health care guaranteed. But it's a prospect the patients and the clinics may soon face. Though Republicans in Washington failed to repeal and replace Obamacare last month amid party infighting, those efforts are far from dead. Speaking just a few days after the Republican health care bill failed, House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who represents Bakersfield, said as much in a press conference.
We promised that we would repeal and replace Obamacare, and that's exactly what we're going to do. Friday, timeline wasn't there. The votes were not there yet. That doesn't mean that we're not going to get there.
Even if the health law doesn't change, Medi-Cal still faces problems. Right now, the federal government is covering all of the expansion costs, but starting this year, the state will have to start picking up more of the tab. Meanwhile, the number of people enrolling in the program is only expected to grow. Without the Medi-Cal expansion, though, the Skid Row clinics say their services and the trust they've built with their patients could fall apart. The John Wesley Clinic's chief medical officer, Dr. Paul Gregerson, says that would mean reverting back to relying on the overburdened county system for anything beyond basic primary care.
Somebody that came in with a hernia would wait a year or more for surgery. Somebody that had a gallbladder that needed to be removed, same thing, would take a long time. Eye appointments, 8-9 months out. So many of the things that needed to be addressed in terms of specialty care, we ended up sending patients to the emergency room.
At L.A. County USC Medical Center near downtown, ER visits that didn't require a hospital admittance dropped 11% after the health law's rollout. Michael Cousineau is a public health professor at the University of Southern California. He says the health law gave homeless individuals more options.
If a person, let's say they needed to see a cardiologist or they needed to see an ophthalmologist or have their annual eye check, then the panel of doctors that were available to are available to see them is much larger. They didn't have to just go to the county.
That was the case for 50-year-old Mary Morgan, a patient at John Wesley Clinic who newly qualified for Medi-Cal under Obamacare. In November, Morgan had back surgery to fix critical damage to her lower spine. She said she'd been dealing with excruciating pain for years. For four of them, she was homeless.
Sleeping on the concrete bears your back even more. So that really led to more pressure, more damaging to me that I wasn't thinking of, because my mind was on trying to get myself together and get going and keep myself alive. And, you know, we don't think about that sometimes, that our body talks to us, but we don't listen.
Morgan currently lives in a shelter on Skid Row. She says right now she's getting physical therapy, but will need another surgery to address more spinal damage. Morgan is relying on Medi-Cal to pick up the bill.
There's been conversations about changing the way that the country insures people, and one of the big things has been whether Medi-Cal, you know, is going to change. What would that mean for you?
Nothing. I won't have anything to insure myself to go to the doctors with. Because we don't have the funds to pay for anything right now. We all are living out here with nothing, you know? And without funding for that, what are we going to have? We're going to get sick and kill over and die when we could be saved, you know? That little medical thing helps a lot of people. Little that they know, it does. Because a lot of us can't afford it, and we need it.
Republicans aren't putting a timeline on a new replacement plan this time around. So at least for now, Morgan can keep her coverage. For Press Play, I'm Michelle Alloy.
Coming up, the director and star of a trippy new show at the Wallace calls his play A Walk Across Your Brain. Simon McBurney on The Encounter. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogaven for Madeline Brand. Back in 2001, I saw a play called Mnemonic that I will never forget. When we walked into the theater, every seat had a Ziploc baggie on it, and a voice over the PA system instructed us to put on the blindfold that we'd find inside. Then the lulling voice told us to find, by touch, a small leaf inside the bag and proceeded to lead us through a series of memory exercises, a collective meditation, really. It was mesmerizing, and it was a fitting opening to a play about the fractured relationship between memory and identity and consciousness. Mnemonic is just one of the many mind-altering productions from the British theater company Complicité, and now they're back with another new show at the Wallace Annenberg Theater. It's called The Encounter.
In a moment, I'm going to ask you to put your headphones on. If I were to breathe in your ear, your brain would tell you that I was really breathing in your ear, and it might even start to get hot. He had the sensation of presence, and then almost instantaneously saw a young man in the forest.
We are both in nature and not.
Simon McBurney is the co-founder of Complicité. He directs and stars in this one-man show, and he was also the hypnotic voice from Mnemonic, and it is such a pleasure to welcome you to Press Play.
Thank you for having me.
So we just heard a kind of complex, layered soundscape part of your show, and we should explain that on the face of it, The Encounter is inspired by a novel based on the true story of a National Geographic photographer, Lauren McIntyre, who found himself lost in a remote part of the Brazilian rainforest back in 1969.
Yeah.
Help us understand what hooked you about that particular story about a story.
Well, as you say, it's a story about this man, Lauren McIntyre, who's a very famous National Geographic photographer, who in 1969 wished to find the source of the Amazon, which had never been found, and there was always a debate as to whether the Amazon was longer than the Nile, but National Geographic said this is not so photographically interesting. However, we have heard that a people called the Mairuna people, who are often referred to in local Brazilian lore as L-O-R-E, I mean, as the cat people, because they had the jaguar at the center of their worlds and they had these extraordinary cat whiskers that they and tattoos on their faces, that, who were thought no longer to exist, were emerging out of the forest, uncontacted people. And they said, National Geographic said, look, if you can get some photographs of these people, maybe we can combine it with funding your trip to find the source of the Amazon. So he was dropped in a very, very remote area of Brazil, on the border with Peru, and he made contact, and then he lost his way back, and he also lost his camera, he lost his bearings, he had to become one of these people. And the consequence of that is the story which I then recount over, you know, an hour and 45 minutes in the theatre.
And this idea that you made a play about a novelization of a
story. I think one of the questions...
It's interesting, the Russian doll nature of that.
Well, one of the questions for me about telling a story of this nature is to do with the nature of what is true, what is real. We, as a species, often think of things as real, which are in fact fictions, because it's the way that we organize ourselves in groups of larger than 150. We're different from Neanderthalers, but the way that we do it is that we use stories. So, for example, I'm here with you because we both believe in something called Thursday, and when it's broadcast, it'll be another time. But none of those things exist outside our common imagination. We take for granted, for example, that we think that the United States of America is real. Well, of course, it's not real. It doesn't exist anywhere. A tree doesn't think of itself as part of the United States of America. That is a human construct. And all of these constructs are simply stories. So at the heart of this piece is the question, what is real and what is not? And of course, the piece itself, the story, is real. It is a documentary fact. It is a retelling of real events.
And we experience this also through the way in which you use the audio. As we heard in the introduction, you play with the audience's perceptions and senses, and you have people put on headphones. And I want to play another clip here from the performance where you introduce the character of Lauren McIntyre.
I've got another microphone here, and I'm going to change the pitch of my voice.
So my voice is going to go down, and as it goes down, for some reason, I want to speak with an American accent. It seems kind of more appropriate. It's not because it's sleazy, even though it sounds a little sleazy. There's no, I'm making no judgment on the United States and the citizens of the United States, but this is the character who is the center of this story. His name is Lauren McIntyre. A story that takes place in 1969, beginning of the 70s, and gradually, as you're listening to me, you yourselves, your brains, you're becoming accustomed to this. That this is my voice, and this is how my voice sounds. So much so
that when you hear my real voice, it suddenly sounds like Mickey Mouse.
It's true, and it does sound a little sleazy. What kind of experience are you going for your audience in using audio technology in this way?
This is a story about a man who's lost, not only physically, but who loses his bearings mentally. And I suppose that's one of the reasons why I wanted to make this piece, because I myself feel kind of lost, like all of us. We've slightly lost our bearings in terms of what is the real and what is the virtual world. And so I wanted people to have an individual experience. I also wanted them to engage their imaginations in a very different way to they might normally do in the theatre. Now, to make them feel alone, if you like, and lost, one way was that everybody should have their own headphones, because then each person has this kind of individual experience. And I have to say, I use something called a binaural head, which allows you to hear sound in space. It's difficult to imagine what that means when you're listening to the radio now, because what you're hearing is what you might call two-dimensional sound. It's just flat, even it sounds as if it's in the middle of your head if you have headphones on or just in front of you.
Binaural is 360. Engulfing.
You can literally hear people behind you and so on. So I, as a consequence, I can place them within the situation of the Amazon rainforest. I can place them in Lauren McIntyre's situation as he travels throughout this story. I can also place them, incidentally, in my home, which is intercut with the story. So you have two stories, like a kind of twist of DNA running through the whole evening. Not only the story of Lauren McIntyre, but also of my daughter, Noma, who wakes up through the night. Why? Because the piece is also about time. What he discovers is that these people are on a journey back in time. In fact, they think of going forward in time because they want to arrive at a place in which the world is without white people anymore, without this colonial imposition, and in which, as it were, nature can start all over again. At the same time, I want people to be conscious, really conscious, almost in a Brechtian sense, of the fact that time is passing in the theatre, what we think of as real time. So my daughter Noma, by waking up and interrupting me throughout the entire show, as sometimes she does, so she holds real time, and then you have what you might call imaginative time, in which you go back to 1969.
That's so interesting. You're laying these parallel realities, these reality constructs, layering them through the sound.
I suppose in many ways, when I make theatre, I tend to think of it as music. So symphonic music works on many different layers. You will have an area of the music which is almost unconscious, which will be the bass section, the harmonies. Obviously, we can hear the melody, but there are many other things that are going on which are triggering us in different ways. Last night, after a talk back, somebody gave an entirely different account of the story to what I thought the story was. And she related it to the fact that her husband had died a few weeks ago and he was present all the way through the piece. Now, that is...
In her experience.
In her experience. But that is a reaction that I'm very happy about, because the proposition is that the audience engage, a little bit like mnemonic, engage their own imaginations and create, if you like, their own show, because theatre is created in the minds of the audience. It's often underestimated, the power, the imaginative power of the audience, what they bring and what they create in that room.
They're reacting to what you're doing on stage
all the time,
as well, right?
Course.
And you're making sound effects on stage.
Yes. I mean, that's sort of... I do that. I evoke the forest, if you like. Again, I make it deliberately fictional, yet strangely, people with the sounds of the forest that I make, they start to really imagine themselves within the forest. So, in other words...
How do you make the forest?
Well, you make very simple noises, ridiculous things, really. But because they're repeated and looped, you have the feeling that a forest grows around you, but you can see it being made. And yet, despite the fact you see how fictional it is, you believe in it. And this is a fundamental aspect of what it means to be human. We could call ourselves, if you like, instead of Homo sapiens, Homo fiction. There's a remarkable book by this man, Noah Yuval Harari, called Sapiens. I don't know if you've read it. But it talks about the nature of the way that we are dependent upon these layers of fiction. That is who we are.
Now, this is intriguing to me, that this piece is so aural and so cerebral, but you get very physical on stage as you're making the sound effects. And there's a lot of movement and exertion going on stage. And when I think of your acting career in film and television, and I should say that you've been in a number of films like The Last King of Scotland and Theory of Everything and Mission Impossible and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and also television comedy roles, your acting is very physical as well, even though you often play these very cerebral types. And I find that a really interesting tension between the mind and the body that seems to run like a thread throughout your work.
Well, that is, of course, also explored here in this piece, because this man's body is pushed to a limit. In many ways, he should not have survived. But the question of our body and our relationship with the outer world, of course, is at the heart of this piece. We, in 2017, in our mass consumer capitalist society, make a very stark distinction, let's call it a dualistic distinction, between our bodies and the rest of the world. We talk about nature as if it's something separate to us. You know, when we say, I'm going out into nature, you kind of go out and you look at the cows, even though that's not nature at all. But the proposition within this piece is that perhaps there is no difference between our inner worlds and the outer world. Perhaps there is, we should think of it as a much greater sense of continuity. In that way, we begin to have, take greater responsibility for the exterior world. If we regard the exterior world as sacred as our inner world, then of course we start to take care of it in the way that we might take care of ourselves. I think at the heart of the piece is this question of this world that we have now created and we're living in, is this the best version of it? Are we headed in the right direction? And because I have my daughter in it, who's 8, it's not only the question of the past or me acting in the present. For me, there is an urgent question of what is going to happen in the future.
Well, your daughter is in the play. She's also in our control room along with your other child. And I want to return you to them and just say it has been fascinating talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Simon McBurney, he directs and stars in The Encounter. The play runs through this Sunday at the Wallace Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts. Warren Olney is here to talk about the near future and what's coming up on To the Point.
I just have to remark on how profound the interview you just did was.
Wonderful.
What an extraordinary man. Really, really, really. We're going to talk about the Trump foreign policy. When, and is there one? And now you see it, now you don't, is the headline on our program today. With all the flip-flops that we've been seeing in very recent days with Syria and Russia and NATO and China back and forth, is this a strength? Is it something that that's good to be unpredictable and never have anybody know what you're going to do? Or do you need some stability and particularly with your allies? We'll be talking about that.
Great, the whiplash effect. Very interested in that coming up. And now coming up on our show, how Uber uses technology to get an edge on their competitors and outrages nearly everybody in the process. Hey, there's a reason they nicknamed their software Hell. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Uber seems to outrage somebody somewhere every week these days. Not only has the ride-sharing service faced allegations of systemic harassment and seen executive after executive head for the hills in recent months, this week news surfaced that Uber may have engaged in unfair business practices to gain an edge over its biggest competitor. And they reportedly did so using software called, and this is no joke, Hell. Well, it's Thursday. You can hear Shenny Chardin is here, and she is she's
hey,
laughing
Barbara.
Already. She's co-editor of Boing.net and our regular web wizardess. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Uber has been in the news a lot recently for reasons that I imagine the people at Uber are none too excited about. We had this sexual harassment story that was all over the New York Times and elsewhere. The issues involving kind of a God's eye view software that they had to try to get around regulators. And this week,
That was called Heaven.
Excuse me, that was called Heaven. Yes.
Yes.
So Hell is, as we all know, the opposite of Heaven. And basically between 2014 and early last year, early 2016, Uber had this Hell. It was kind of a joke, but it's still
right,
it's a bad branding idea, even for internal software.
And
but
this
they
is
were
tracking
using this
software.
Yeah, so basically they would create these fake Lyft accounts. Perhaps they generated them automatically. Fake Lyft drivers, so that they could see into the system of their competitor and see what the demand, what the availability was, and the rates that the Lyft drivers were charging at that time. So just like both of the services have this sort of flexible pricing model that adapts to supply and demand, and Uber, you got to admit, it's kind of ingenious.
Like, I was going to say,
if you're going to be aggressive, this is an ingenious form of corporate aggression.
Right. And Uber also used Hell to lure drivers away from driving for Lyft? Or is that
in a
kind
sense,
of in question?
One could interpret it that way. I'm sure Uber's attorneys would argue otherwise. But the intent here was to have visibility into which Uber drivers were also driving on the side for the competitor, Lyft. Now, you know, full disclosure here, I use Uber a lot. I am a cancer patient, and sometimes you can't drive. So I love it. It changed my life after my cancer treatment began. And, you know, one of the things that I've seen in many of my, like, thousands of Uber rides is that a lot of the drivers here in L.A., they don't just work for one service. Maybe it's Uber for part of the time and Lyft for another, sometimes concurrently. So long story short, hell could be used by Uber executives to see which drivers were on the books for both service and then help figure out how to get double-timing drivers to drive exclusively for Uber.
Okay, so is this legal? If it's true they used hell this way.
We don't know yet, and we won't know until that's fought out in the courts. But what we do know is that if the accusations hold, the charges of breach of contract, unfair business practices, the violations of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the CFAA, and stealing trade secrets, these are all things that carry very heavy penalties that I'm sure Uber would not like to have those problems, and yet those are now Uber's problems.
Well, it's a very dicey thing, too, because you could say this is just capitalism as usual at work. I mean, these are small profit margins, right? And they're trying to get be competitive, and they're really successful at being competitive. Or are you arguing that this is something specifically to do with this gig economy and this air quote sharing economy?
A few layers of what's going on here with Uber's woes. First, Travis Kalanick has a very particular personality style.
The CEO
Uber. And founder, kind of internet bad boy, former Napster guy back in the day. He's a really smart guy, and he knows how to see opportunities and capitalize on them. We've seen Travis make some really bad high-profile public blunders.
Well, there's the caught
yelling at his own driver in an abusive way. Former engineer, the harassment allegations came up. It just complete tone-deaf cultural response, joking that the nickname of Uber is Boober for all the ladies it gets him. A couple weeks ago, documentation of a talking...
Like a 12-year-old.
Taking Uber employees to an escort service bar in South Korea. Like, leadership matters, you know? So it's not a surprise that there is such a kind of an abusive culture that so many people talk about there, and that these forms of innovation are just so kind of cutthroat. So they have ridden far on aggression, and aggression might be the thing that takes them down.
Well, another thing, there's another executive, Rachel Whetstone. She's senior VP of Policy and Communications, and she's just the latest of several higher-ups to jump ship from Uber.
Not the only one. I feel like we see one of those stories in the New York Times every week or so now.
Right, and I guess the question is, one, does it matter what the CEO, what his behavior is like? Do the boycotts work? Does it matter if their aggressive management style produces profits? And two, does it matter that there's this rotating management happening, a kind of Game of Thrones of Uber?
Yeah. I mean, you can get away with that stuff in a startup for a while when there's crazy money coming in and unlimited opportunity and greed. Greed is in the air, right? You can coast a long way with that. But I've been in a few startups in my time, Barbara.
You've been there, done that.
I can tell you. It wears off, you know, the glow wears off, and eventually the consequences of those kinds of choices from the top down come home to roost.
And is there another element of this that the ride-sharing economy or the gig economy is not as regulated?
Yeah, you mentioned that before, and I'm glad you brought that up again. You know, on Boing Boing, on our blog, on a bunch of other kind of think PC places, I'm seeing people talk more and more about how the so-called gig economy was promised to be this sort of empowering thing for workers, where I, as a freelance creative, could go do a comedy club thing tonight and an audition tomorrow
and hop in my Uber and
earn my rent and maybe go over here and do some Lyft and then do some TaskRabbit stuff while I'm at it. Well, as it turns out, the large venture-backed companies with more money than God that are running those services, they don't have their workers' best interest at heart. That's not what the point of the company is. It's a very mercenary way to develop to develop an entire new marketplace. It's not about the social fabric. It's not about making sure that people have health insurance. It's not about ensuring that there's a middle class in America.
It's not about sharing.
It's not about sharing. We're not sharing rides here. We're just paying for them. And many of the drivers that I've talked to on and off the record, there's greater concern now. And I think less of a sense of loyalty towards the company. You know, I really feel for these people. They're our fellow Angelinos, right? They're people who are just trying to earn a living. So for their sake, I can't hate on Uber, because that's hating on all the nice men and women who have ferried me to and from, you know, my radiation appointments in Uber, or like to the grocery store when I was too sick to get groceries. They're good people, and I hope that we find a way to bring humanity and compassion back into some of the business equations.
The never-hating Shenny Chardin. She's co-editor of boingboing.net and a regular web commentator, and always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks, Barbara.
Jolie Myers here to talk about the feedback that I don't remember asking for. What are people thinking about?
You don't even have to ask for
See?
It.
See? That's how good our listeners are.
And there's many ways to ask, Barbara. I asked people things on Facebook, for instance. So even if...
Didn't mean to diss your social media acumen.
How dare you, Bogave.
So what'd you get?
On Facebook, our listeners wanted to talk about Uber today. Mitch Gavin says, oh man, Uber should be fined, shut down, and held accountable for endless infractions. Not just their hell software, but all kinds of other things, including the history of them driving without any sort of state-sanctioned okay in the early years of the service. Mitch Gavin says, throw it out. Lauren Valencia says that she left Uber months ago because Lyft seemed much better for drivers and riders. And I'm actually interested in hearing from drivers.
I am too. Yeah. That's right. I mean, I think we have that bias, but I'm not sure the facts back it up. I don't know how well Lyft treats its drivers compared to Uber.
I think it would be lovely to hear from drivers on both sides on what exactly draws you to either company or both at the same time. A lot of people think of them as interchangeable, but I know that it works differently. So they can ride share their feedback.
Right. And there are other companies out there, too, and some that cater to women. That
I heard you mention Scoop in that last
Scoop, yes.
Thing. I have
we
never heard of Scoop.
We looked up a bunch of rides. They might not serve our market, though.
Okay. Well, I just gave you the scoop on feedback.
And the old Google came in handy there. Jolie Myers, thank you so much for your feedback. And that's it for us for today. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Barbara Bogave. I'll see you tomorrow here on KCRW.